Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me today is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilburn.
And hello, everyone. It's another fairly nice fall day. It's not raining or snowing.
a good day to think about good food.
Oh, my, and have we got a book for that. Goodness gracious.
So who is our guest today, Mom?
Well, today is Lisa Joy Mitchell, and she's a busy public relations consultant. And she was drawn to the study of Ayurvedic cooking in 1998, when chronic health problems began taking center stage in her fast-paced life. On her road to wellness, she changed her diet and began an informal study with Ayurvedic physicians Dr. Vasant Ladd and Ed Danaher in the United States and Dr. Smita Naram in India. She's now a wellness mentor and cooking instructor based in Raleigh, North Carolina. And this book is really something. I mean, it's just amazing. It isn't just recipes. It's the whole history in a way of Ayurvedic, and she explains it so well that, you know, people who've been doing this, even I think even people who've been cooking like this and following this should get this book. I really do.
And the title is Sacred and Delicious,
yes.
Modern Ayurvedic Cookbook. Welcome
right.
to Writer's Voices, Lisa.
Thank you so much for that introduction, Monica and Caroline. I so appreciate it, and I'm delighted to be here.
And another thing I want to say about the book, it's a beautiful book. It has lovely photos, lovely cover, and a really nice feel to it.
Uh-huh.
Oh,
yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah,
I had a great photographer, so it really made that food come to life, didn't it?
It did.
Oh, it did.
It did. Now, is this the first cookbook that you've written?
It's the first book I've written, and yes, the first cookbook.
And why did you decide to do this?
Well, it's a bit of a story. I was a busy public relations professional, working on deadline all the time, and I was a little bit of a workaholic. And by the time I was in my early 40s, I really began having some fairly serious chronic health problems. And the short story is I found Ayurveda, and I really started to get better. The longer version of that is that my husband, who is a chiropractic physician, had been studying Ayurveda for quite some time, was always planning to have a full holistic practice, but he was not yet offering Ayurvedic treatments in his office, so he had some Ayurvedic herbs. And so when my health really started to spiral downward, and I was suffering a good bit, I couldn't digest anything and had some chronic pain, and that led to also some sleep disorder, he suggested that I go to the Ayurvedic Institute in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And that's where I met Dr. Vasant Ladd, who's one of the great educators in Ayurveda. And at the end of 5 days, I did a short detox program, which is, you know, simple foods and colon cleansing. At the end of the 5 days, I really felt so much better. Plus, I was just so impressed with the whole atmosphere of the way that we were treated as patients, with so much respect and tenderness, and looking at us from the soul. When he looked into your eyes, I knew he was looking into my very being, and I thought, oh, this is the kind of healthcare that I really want. And so that was the very beginning.
Well, that's, you know, that certainly explains your interest and your dedication to Ayurvedic cooking. But
right.
Most people who go get Ayurvedic treatments don't end up writing a cookbook.
Well, I should go a little further than that, shouldn't I? Well, so what happened was this. I started studying Ayurvedic cooking for myself. And, of course, Ayurveda comes out of India. And traditional Ayurvedic cuisine is Indian-style cuisine, though not really with the chilies, which is not part of traditional Ayurveda. But even so, after a few weeks of doing that kind of cooking at home, you know, I grew up in the South. I grew up in a Jewish family. I'm used to American-style cuisines. And while I really wanted to embrace an Ayurvedic approach to diet day in and day out, I didn't want to eat Indian food, and no offense to my Indian friends. And so I decided to start really going, diving deeper, learning about the principles of balance of Ayurveda and understanding how different foods impact different people and that sort of thing, which we can go into later. And so I decided that I really could apply those same principles to all these different cuisines and even some comfort foods that I really love and enjoy. And over time, I just was so excited because my health really began to improve dramatically over the next few years. I even had a frozen shoulder, which was an excruciating, painful condition where my shoulder became completely immobile, and it was so difficult. And I went back to the Institute. I did another five-day colon cleanse, and that was when I just really got that this was a powerful and profound healing path. And it's just my nature. You know, I've been doing PR all my life. I have a lot of general enthusiasm, and I wanted to be able to help other people either avoid or better manage or sometimes even reverse chronic conditions like I've had, because I could see that this was possible. And so that was really the beginning of why I started writing a cookbook.
Now, have you always enjoyed cooking?
You know, sort of, not so much. I mean, I always loved delicious food, but I was a bit of a workaholic. And so, like a lot of working people, I didn't take much time to cook during the week. I would cook some on weekends, and maybe once or twice in the middle of the week, I would do, you know, a great soup or something like that out of a Molly Katzen cookbook. She's a great vegetarian cook, or, you know, Deborah Madison, one of those great vegetarian cookbooks. But I wasn't really exploring it or experimenting with it. And I got to eat out a lot. We are wined and dined a lot in the PR field. So, no, I wasn't always interested in cooking, but when I started having health problems and I realized that changing my diet just a little bit and then a little bit more, you know, I made gradual changes over time, when I realized that I could take responsibility for my health and well-being, somehow I got excited about it. I guess it was when I created one or two really great recipes and friends were around the table and they said, oh, wow, that's really delicious. And I think even one of those friends said, why don't you write a cookbook, because it really hadn't occurred to me. But I just began to get excited about the creative process of creating new foods that mm-hmm. are still so healthy but so delicious.
Well, they certainly look delicious from the pictures. And I was interested in what you said, too, about how could every person possibly benefit from every new discovery that food science unveils?
Exactly.
That's
one of the primary tenets of Ayurveda. In fact, I've heard in one of Dr. Law's lectures, you know, when he says that this new thing comes out and everybody says everybody should eat X, and he says the real question is, for whom? This is good for whom? Because as we know, as you probably know, because you're probably familiar with Ayurveda, Ayurveda really had first mind-body system, you know, of types, a type system, a framework. And in that framework, you start to learn that there's certain foods that are good for one type, and there are other foods that might aggravate that type. And this framework is what I became fascinated with studying because it really helped me connect the dots between all my various health problems. You know, in Western medicine, there's a tendency to just treat symptoms, not look at underlying causes as much as in the holistic practices of Ayurveda, Chinese medicine, naturopathy, and so forth. And so you're going to all these different doctors and taking all these different drugs, when Ayurveda would say, hey, let's stop for a minute and look at first the pulse, which will tell you a lot about your body, and see what the underlying cause is. What are the imbalances in your life and that are showing up in your body and in your mind and your emotions that are actually all linked by some of the same systems or patterns?
Well, our bodies are so complex anyway. I mean, and each person is different. I mean, that's,
yes.
And yeah, I think that's the secret. Each person is different.
Each person is different. And I would also say that Ayurveda is actually a very complex, comprehensive medical and wellness system itself. Mm-hmm. But what I found out, because I can't study this full time, I've been doing a lot of other things, including taking care of my 91-year-old mom for several years. But if you only learn a few fundamental principles, just that little bit of knowledge, which is what I think I have, it's like a thimbleful of knowledge in this vast field of Ayurveda. But if we can just understand these four or five key principles, then we have the tools we need to assess our own health through this system, through this framework I've been talking about. And we also have the tools right there in my book and other books like mine to begin to eat differently so that we can begin to make a change.
If someone's coming to Ayurveda with no knowledge about it, what is the first thing that you would tell them?
Well, the first thing I would do is ask them a question, is your wellness goals and what kinds of health problems are you having that you want to address? That's the first thing that I would want to talk about, because I don't think we can throw the whole book of Ayurveda at people.
If someone doesn't know anything about Ayurveda, what is it, you know, sort of what's the basic foundation of it that makes it different from other systems?
Oh, okay, great.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think what Ayurveda is about balance. So there are three main types in Ayurveda that are about either mobility, metabolism, and structure that exist in all creation. All living creatures and all human beings have these patterns or principles, that dynamic principles that are working in our body. And so we're looking to uncover what is the basic imbalance you're experiencing, and therefore how can we balance it. Now, the very best way to do that is if you can go to an Ayurvedic physician, someone who has practiced and can take your pulse. But if you can't do that, then Sacred and Delicious, and as I said, other books about Ayurveda, will help you look at these types, which are called Vata, Pitta, and Kapha, to talk about, again, mobility and metabolism and structure. And then we can begin to develop a diet that will better support you. And I would say also, and just to finish answering your question, how is an Ayurvedic cookbook different from other cookbooks, as we're not saying that every food is good for everybody, as Caroline had said earlier on. But most people can eat most foods when they learn some of the tools of balance. So there are lots of ways of balancing the foods that are on your plate, because different people around your table may have some different needs. So, for instance, cruciferous vegetables, which are great for two of the types but not for the other, can be balanced because cruciferous vegetables tend to be a little bit cooling in nature, and they're a little bit bitter or astringent. So you can add something that's a counterbalance to them, so some fresh ginger, for instance, or lots of fresh ginger, or maybe something a little bit sweet with it. So you add some sweet potatoes or some sweet winter squash with it, and that dish becomes more balanced so that everybody can eat it, enjoy it well.
One thing, when you mentioned that you've been taking care of your 91-year-old mother, mm-hmm. have you introduced her to this way of eating, and if so, how has she responded?
She really has been my biggest fan, and she went whole hog with it for a while. Many years ago, I think it was about 2004, she was diagnosed with breast cancer, and she had a mastectomy, and she was still living on her own then. She was independent, and she began eating a lot of khichdi because it was easy to make. She thought it was delicious. This is a dish that is made from a very simple lentil, a dal, is the Indian term for the the category of legumes called pulses. So it's a split mung bean that is so easy to digest with a little bit of basmati rice and vegetables. And she started eating that a lot, and she began actually to lose some weight. She was a little bit overweight. She was feeling better than she ever had for many years.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. Our guest today is Lisa Joy Mitchell, author of Sacred and Delicious, a Modern Ayurvedic Cookbook.
Well, the thing is, of course, when we go into the grocery store, okay, we have the produce section, and a lot of grocery stores, this local one that we have here, does have an organic section. So that's, you know, that's good. But the majority of the things in the grocery store are processed foods.
Right.
So you have to be very careful.
Yeah, you do have to have a lot of willingness. And I think, and that's different for everyone. For me, I was suffering enough that I was willing to make a change. And I did find out also that I am gluten intolerant. So that was hard for me to give up because I love bread, and I finally learned to bake. I have a gluten-free bread recipe in my book. But I don't eat bread very often anymore. It started to fall away from me. I think as you're eating a healthier and healthier diet that's fresh foods all the time, you start to notice a difference when you add the other stuff back in if you've been willing to give it up for a little while. And I would really recommend that listeners try that, to give up some processed foods more and more and eat fresh foods, because fresh foods are the foods that have high prana, or the vital life force that's in foods. That it's food that's alive. And processed foods are made to live on the shelf sometimes for years.
That's right.
And so it's really dead food. It has no prana, no vital force. So it's really, it doesn't support your body. It will keep you from dying, probably, if you were starving. You might have to eat some packaged food. But if you don't have to make that choice, you can be amazed how much better you'll feel without it. And fresh food is so much more delicious.
Well, I'm also a gluten intolerant, and it's interesting. Donuts don't even appeal to me anymore.
Right, me too. Yeah.
And I used to love a good donut, but I don't.
Yeah,
but they do have
too.
Gluten-free donuts. They do have gluten-free donuts now, and they have gluten-free most anything.
Right.
Pizza crust, and, you can get a gluten-free pizza, and it tastes just like any other pizza, I think. I don't know.
Yeah.
I haven't had one for so long, but
just keep telling yourself that, Mom.
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I never had a lot of pizza in the beginning. I've never been a great pizza fan, so I guess it doesn't make any difference.
There are some times where the gluten-free is as good as the other, but not too often in my
opinion. I would like to bet you, if you try some of my recipes, that you will think they're delicious. Every time I take them to any kind of event, people always say to me, and this was before a book was written with this title, I can't believe it's gluten-free.
Ah.
So they really are delicious. And what I'd like to say about my desserts is that they have nothing to do with traditional Ayurveda. That's one reason why my title says Modern Ayurveda. But, I live in the United States of America, and we are going to eat our chocolate chip cookies every once in a while, and we do want to bake a birthday cake for our beloved friends or family, and I certainly want a piece of chocolate cake on my birthday. So what I decided to do was to create healthier versions of those desserts. And, in fact, if I can tell you and your listeners a little secret, the working title of my book when I first got started was Healthy Comfort Food. And I was using that. Yeah, I was using that for the first few years. I actually had a really amazing macaroni and cheese recipe in it at that time, which I did take out, but I might put on my blog sometime. And then anyway.
Why'd you take it out?
Well, it just seems so not Ayurveda to me, all that cheese. Cheese is really bad for pitta and kapha. and those types that we were talking about before. And I've stopped eating dairy for the most part myself. I find I feel better without it. So I took it out. But my point being that I started with healthy comfort food, and then a marketing whiz friend of mine said, "Do you have the .com?" And even though I used to be a marketing whiz myself, I hadn't gotten the .com. And so, you know, I thought, oops, what am I going to do now? But I took it as an opportunity. I thought there must be something better for me. And I started brainstorming, and these words, sacred and delicious, kind of just floated up to my consciousness. And I thought, oh, that sounds beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I just saw it as an invitation to go in a different direction, but to go deeper and to explore my own sacred relationship with food. And that's why it took some more years to write the book, but it was well worth it. And it also took some more years for me to write the book when I became gluten-free, because before that, I was baking just with spelt, which has gluten in it. I kept a couple of spelt breads in the book because not everybody has to be gluten-free, and they're really delicious recipes, but everything else in the book is gluten-free.
Yeah, I like spelt bread quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of my favorites.
Oh, good. I think you'll like that.
And fortunately, living here in Fairfield, I can get it at the grocery store, at our natural food store, made
very
locally.
Good.
And it's made locally and
great.
Made fresh. Yeah. Yeah, it is good.
Nice.
So, as many of our listeners know, I am in Fairfield, Iowa. Mom's down the road in Mount Pleasant, Iowa. And we have an Ayurvedic clinic here called the Raj.
Oh, yes. I've heard of the Raj. It's famous. And I'm sorry I haven't been there yet, but I hope to go there one day.
Oh, that would we hope you come. But you do have some connection with Fairfield, I understand.
Yeah. My husband spent a year or two there. This was before I met him. He did a master's in education there at the university, Maharishi University.
Wow. Has he ever come back to visit?
No, but we're planning a trip, probably sometime in 2019. His best friend who initiated him in transcendental meditation back when he was in college lived in Fairfield, Iowa again. So we've been planning a trip there.
So many people in this community mm-hmm. at least try and follow an Ayurvedic diet
mm-hmm.
and are certainly interested in it. One thing I really like about your book is that you're not rigid about it.
True. I mean, after all, I have some desserts in it.
Right.
Yeah.
But even things like, you know, I hear all the time people don't, you know, tomatoes are bad, but what do you say about tomatoes in your book?
Well, I say that they are bad for some people, and because they have this, first, they're deadly nightshades, and they're in that category of foods, along with white potatoes, peppers, and chili peppers as well. And it's alpha-solanine that is inflammatory. Now, not everybody reacts to the alpha-solanine, but a lot of people do. But on top of that, so what that means is it's inflammatory. So I have a little bit of arthritis in my hands, say. I mostly don't eat tomatoes, but I love tomatoes. And so every once in a while, a few times a year for me, maybe a little bit more than that, I treat myself to a dish that has tomatoes in it. But the next day, my hands hurt.
Hmm.
So it's a choice. And the nightshades are just not the best foods to eat all the time. What I say, and what I've heard some other physicians say, you know, what matters the most is what you eat day in and day out. So if you're cooking with tomatoes all the time, it's probably not the best idea. They also really aggravate the fire element in the body, and that can cause a lot of health problems. And that's everything from acne, all kinds of skin conditions like eczema, psoriasis, other kinds of rashes, any kind of general itching. It can also, too much heat in the body can lead to headaches. It can lead to irritability. You know, hot-tempered doesn't come from nowhere. It's from too much heat in the system, in the metabolism. So there are reasons, and they're sour also. So that sour taste will aggravate the fire element in the body. So there are reasons not to eat them all the time, but I have, I think, maybe three recipes in the book for the most that have some tomatoes in them. I have this marvelous chickpea soup. But one of the things I do is I balance it out. So the chickpea soup has some sun-dried tomatoes in it. But using the principle of balance that's in Ayurveda, it also has sweet potatoes. So the sweet counteracts the sour some. And also, Vasant Lad says that, and maybe other doctors do too, say that cumin is the antidote for tomatoes. So it also has cumin and coriander. So cumin and coriander spices are balancing to Agni, to the digestive fire, the digestive enzymes.
Now, it doesn't. The cooking of tomatoes does not help the situation any, I'm assuming.
Well, I think raw tomatoes are considered the hardest on the body, so cooking might help them some, and especially because foods that are cooked together begin to take on the qualities of the other foods in the pot. So if there are a lot of other foods in the pot, then it's going to balance it somewhat. But if you make a tomato-based vegetable soup every day, I don't think that you get total forgiveness for that. But you'll know in your own body. If you don't react to it, if you don't have any kind of pain or irritability or skin problems happening, then maybe you're not a person who reacts to it.
Right. Another thing I was interested in, I had heard and read a lot of times about rice having the arsenic in it. And that's, you know, that's really disturbing because, of course, some people, that's all they have to eat is rice in the world.
Yeah, it's terrible. I know. When I first discovered this, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago, I don't remember when I first started reading about it, but I was horrified. And I actually rarely eat rice anymore. It's bothersome to me because they've done studies. They see that, I think especially children in those countries where there's so much reliance on rice, they're starting to see a much higher incidence, I think, of bladder cancers and maybe kidney. I'm not remembering the specifics on that. So they say that there are some ways to lessen the impact of the arsenic. You soak it, you rinse it a couple of times, you cook it with more water and then pour it off. So when I do cook it, I do that. But I have tended to replace rice with millet and sometimes with quinoa.
And, well, of course, and brown rice is terrible, is worse because
Exactly. The brown rice is worse because the reason why there is the arsenic poisoning is because of the water supply has been contaminated with fertilizers that contain the arsenic. And so the brown rice, the outer kernel of the rice, is more exposed to the arsenic.
Mm-hmm. So what about organically grown rice? Does it still have the same amount of arsenic?
It's not the same amount. What I've read is that particularly California organic rice has a lower percentage of arsenic, but you know, there's still there's still some percentage of non-organic arsenic. So in other words, there's some arsenic, organic arsenic that's natural to the soil, but this inorganic arsenic comes from the fertilizer contamination.
So if a place that grew rice was using organic growing methods for many years, does that arsenic dissipate?
I would think that that would be much safer, if you knew that.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. But a lot of rice, of course, is grown in the South, and that rice is known to have a much higher contamination rate than in California, which is much cleaner in terms of their regulations.
Isn't it, you said, I think at one point that places where that grew cotton was...
Yeah, exactly.
More, yeah.
Right where I grew up. Wow. Yeah, it's sad.
Well, you know, you can learn an awful lot if you read and believe, but you know, it's like you say in one place here, there's a lot of false things that go out over the air too, and people tend to believe them. And how do you know? Well, You have to have a book like this to figure it out.
Well, I think one of the things that is great about Ayurveda, I mean, there are lots of fad diets out there, and some of them probably are very meaningful and really help people, but Ayurveda has lasted for 5,000 or 6,000 years, and it has always worked and continues to be relevant today for many people. And I would also say to people who are on those other kinds of diets like paleo, keto, whole, 30, I don't know the names of all of them, but you can still find some information staying on that kind of diet if it's working for you, but you can supplement that knowledge by understanding which vegetables, which fruits, which meats, so forth, work for your type versus those that don't.
And really, the best way to tell is how things make you feel.
Exactly. And I say that again and again in my book. And it's, you know, the first thing I think people need to do if they're going to start to follow an Ayurvedic diet and haven't before is see if they can first start to cut out some of the packaged and processed foods, refined foods, as we talked about. Mm-hmm. And then maybe just start seeing a little bit at a time how you feel making individual choices. I have a plan, I think, at the back, towards the end of the front part of the book, where I talk about taking things a step at a time and not, you know, some people can go cold turkey and give everything up at once. But I don't like to emphasize too much about what we have to give up. I really prefer to emphasize all the delicious food you can still eat on an Ayurvedic diet every day.
Well, I just want to mention the names of some of your recipes because they
sound
so enticing. Like soups, broccoli soup with almond butter.
Oh, my God. That's one of my – I'm sorry. I'm interrupting you. But that is probably my very favorite recipe in the whole book. And when I'm having company over for the first time, I usually serve that dish because it's really simple to make. It's very rich, so it's very filling, and it's divine.
And then
it was a divine
roasted
inspiration.
Squash soup with glazed pecan garnish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very nice.
Chickpea soup with sun-dried tomatoes and olives that we talked about before.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Broccoli with caramelized onion masala. Tell me a little bit about that one.
Yeah, that one's a little bit more of a traditional Indian-style dish and has some Indian-style spices in it. I haven't made it very recently, but my memory of it is that you make what's called a tarka, so these are sizzling spices that you add to the end. And I think that is one of the recipes that has some tomatoes in it, doesn't it? So it starts with some caramelized onions and then some cooked tomatoes, and you add the broccoli. You cook the broccoli till it's just tender. Then you add this sizzling tarka on top with mustard seeds, cumin, coriander, turmeric, I'm sure. I can't remember quite else what's in it. But it is really divine, and it is wonderful over something like quinoa or millet or, yes, even rice.
How about the stuffed chard with black-eyed pea pate?
Oh, that is a special occasion recipe. It's one of the two or three recipes in the book that I call a project recipe. Takes a few hours to cook, so you need an afternoon to do it. And I think I first made it on a Valentine's Day. I like to create new dishes on Valentine's to surprise my husband. And so I start with, I roast some winter squash. And while that's roasting, I cook the black-eyed peas, which is a very southern dish, but of course it's a great vegetarian legume. And once they're cooked, while they're cooking, I'm sizzling some onions and caramelizing them. Maybe I had put a little bit of white wine in that until the wine cooked off. And then I mix the beans with cumin and coriander, ginger and garlic. So these are, and probably a little asafoetida if I have some around. Some people pronounce it asafoetida or hing. This is a spice that helps digest hard beans. And so then I mash it, and that's why I call it a pâté. I then I cook some chard leaves, dip them in the boiling water, pull them out, and then I roll them up. I dry them off, and I put in a layer of the pâté, a layer of some mashed squash mashed with just salt and ghee. I roll it up, and then final step is I make a shiitake mushroom sauce, which is not vegan, though you can make it vegan, but I make it with almond milk. And I make fresh almond milk every day. My husband bought a Vitamix maybe 15 or 20 years ago, And I thought, oh, one more thing. But I love that one more thing. It takes about 5 minutes to make fresh almond milk. And once you've tasted fresh almond milk, you'll never want to have any out of a box anymore. It's just so pure, none of those gums and guar gum and that sort of thing in it, preservatives. And so it tastes like milk. And so I make the shiitake mushroom sauce with the almond milk and pour it over these baked stuffed chard leaves.
Oh, my.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Lisa Joy Mitchell, author of Sacred and Delicious, a Modern Ayurvedic Cookbook. Lisa, would you like to read a little bit from the introductory section of the book?
Oh, sure.
Great.
Let me pull that page open. This reading that I'm going to share with you, we've talked a lot about food and some about Ayurveda, but we haven't talked about the part, the sacred in the title of Sacred and Delicious. And I did mention that I saw that title as an exploration of my sacred relationship with food. So this is what I'll read for you. Ayurveda recognizes that food is necessary not only to sustain life, but also to maintain an optimal quality of life so that we can perform our dharma, our life's purpose. Ayurveda recognizes food as energy, not just fuel, mind you, but as an expression of divine consciousness, the living power of creation. In other words, food does not only come from God. Food is the energy of God. Food is part of God. This understanding of the true nature of food and all creation is articulated in every mystical spiritual tradition. As my friend Rabbi Rachel Jurevich says, it's all God stuff. Once we acknowledge our sustenance as divine energy, we give ourselves an opportunity to engage in a new relationship with food. Rather than seeing it as a mere object in our lives, we see food as a form of God, as consciousness itself. Recognizing this truth intellectually and knowing it experientially are, of course, two different things. But even the most elementary understanding adds a deeper level of meaning to the exclamation, "This food is divine."
And that
is that
was,
long enough?
That's great. That was Lisa Joy Mitchell reading from Sacred and Delicious, a Modern Ayurvedic Cookbook.
And she has another thing, is how to eat. And I wrote this down, allow enough time. Now that's crucial to a lot of people. And sit down.
Isn't it?
Sit down. Eat only. And that's another thing a lot of people never do.
Pause. Yeah, too many people are eating on the run now, right? And I find I get indigestion if I'm not taking a moment to sit down and take a few deep breaths before I eat.
Mm-hmm.
I also offer a prayer before I eat. And prayer's not everybody's thing, but if you just take a couple deep breaths to just slow your mind down and slow your body down.
Right.
It will absolutely improve your digestion.
And then you say, be present with your food.
Yeah.
And that's part of the whole thing. Be present with what you're doing. And you're going to enjoy it more if you do that.
Absolutely.
And then
how can you savor it if you aren't paying attention to it?
That's right. I know sometimes when I eat a treat, I eat it fast, and I wish, why didn't I slow down and savor that, you know?
Yeah. Sometimes you finish eating it, and like, did I eat that? I don't even remember eating it.
Yeah.
Exactly. In fact, in the book, at the end of the front section of the book, before I go into the recipes, I give this little contemplation about taking a minute to trace the feeling you have of the joy you're feeling about the food back to the source. To take a moment to pause and savor the taste of food. So there's something about giving people an experience of that if they'd want to try that at home.
And then you say, chew one bite at every bite at least 20 times. Mm-hmm. That's very good advice.
It's good advice. I don't always follow that advice, and I'm so glad you reminded me.
Well, for somebody who has some trouble with, I can't even think what it is now, but it's very good advice because most of us sit down, we start to eat, we just start eating fast.
Yeah,
you know?
We kind of gallop through the meal, don't we?
Yeah. Eat slowly. Put fork down between each bite. Now, that's a good policy to slow you down.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the thing. As a child, I was a very slow eater. And I was always told to eat faster.
Well, now you have permission to go back to your natural state.
Right. I actually had to learn to eat fast after I was grown and married, because if I didn't eat fast enough, my ex-husband would take the food that was on my plate once he was done with his.
So it wasn't all my fault.
No.
Oh, that's funny.
No. I don't think you necessarily told me to eat faster, but I know that I was often the last one at the dinner table. And then at school, you know, because you have lunch, and then when you're done eating, you get to go out to recess. So kids are motivated to eat as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So that they have more time to play.
Right.
So maybe we should be rethinking that.
Yeah, maybe. Well, we still need time to play. That's really key to essential balance in life. I haven't done enough of that lately, and I'm looking forward to doing it again.
Uh-huh. Now, are all your recipes original?
Most of them original, but maybe even as many as a dozen were given to me by friends. I would sometimes adapt them. Some, you know, just my general friend pool, American friends, I would adapt them so that they fit the Ayurvedic model better, or, you know, made them gluten-free or took the cheese out or something like that. So I've adapted a number of recipes, and the Indian recipes I've learned, have learned all of those from friends, and just maybe adapted them just a little bit. In terms of the spices that I like best, and I never use the chilies. I always tell this story. There's a friend at our table named Hari who said he never tasted the taste of Tur Dal till he ate it at my table, because they use so many chilies in most Indian households nowadays that you couldn't taste the actual flavor of the lentil. And he would laugh when he was saying that. So I don't use chilies in my dishes. So some people will say I'm afraid of eating Indian food. You won't be afraid of mine. It's very flavorful, but there's nothing hot. It's not hot to the tongue, because that's actually not a part of traditional Ayurvedic cuisine. The chilies were introduced by not the Spaniards, but somewhere in the 15th century.
Wow.
They were introduced to India.
Oh, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when you're developing a recipe, were you necessarily developing it for the cookbook, or did most of these you just develop them for your own pleasure?
Well, I think some initial 20 recipes or so were just for our table, and then when I decided to create a cookbook, then I got more serious about developing recipes and being more creative and spending more time with them. And in fact, I still have all those spiral notebooks that I just hand wrote list of ingredients, and I started inputting the ingredients into my computer sometime around 2004, 2005. I've been working on this project very part-time, on and off for forever, it seems. But then I had to learn how to write a recipe. I didn't even have any instructions in them. So it was a long time coming, this project.
Yeah, how do you learn to do that? I guess just by looking at other cookbooks.
Yeah, I just started writing down what I did, and then my mom set me straight. She says, well, you have to put the ingredients in the same order that your instructions are in. So then I started reading a couple of good cookbooks. I looked at a Mark Bittman cookbook. He's a New York Times best-selling author and longtime writer for the New York Times page, and a couple of other good cookbooks that I've mentioned before, and just saw, you know, kind of how they state things. And then I realized because there's certain ingredients that are repeated, like these mixtures of Indian spices in those kinds of dishes, that it would be most helpful to a reader if I always gave the directions in the same way every time so it's not confusing. So I went back and did a lot of editing to make sure there was a lot of consistency for people who've never cooked with those spices before. And one of the things I'd like to say to your listeners is that when you hear about spices, if you've only ever cooked with salt and pepper, as many people in the Midwest and the South have done, that and butter, or maybe a little basil or oregano, I would say, you know, don't be scared of a list with several spices in it. Because once you buy them or buy them one at a time and they're in your cabinet, you just pull them out and it doesn't take but two more minutes to add them to your recipe. So it's not going to make a recipe more difficult to cook, and it might expand your palate. It might explode in your mouth in a way that you absolutely love. And you'll decide if you don't like a certain spice, then just leave that out of the recipe the next time you make it.
How many different versions of the average recipe did you make before you decided on the final version?
Well, I have to tell you that broccoli soup was like terrific the first time. I might have modified it once or twice, just a little bit here and there. And then I spent the most time modifying my baked goods because it's not that I grew up learning how to bake. So I was learning how to bake at the same time I was learning how to put these recipes together. And then I had to learn how to bake gluten-free. And I created all my gluten-free recipes before the books came out called, I Can't Believe It's Gluten-Free. I think that's the name of the cookbooks. And those didn't exist at the time when I was creating these recipes. So I did a lot of trial and error. So some of my cakes, a couple of my cakes, I bet I tested 15 or 20 times before I was totally satisfied, because I changed it. You know, first it was spelt, and then it had eggs, and then I decided to make a vegan version, and then I decided to change it to almond flour and one of those gluten-free flour mixes, but they're so full of rice starch and tapioca and potato starch.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't want to have all that really, really high starch product in the cake. So then I started all over again and started making them with almond flour and just oat flour. And most of them worked, but a couple of them just didn't hold their structure well enough. So then I did it a third and a third. So it was almond, oat, and then some of the King Arthur gluten-free mix, which is what holds them together the best.
Oh, interesting. Well, I guess it's good that it was the baked goods that you had to make over and over again, because your family isn't going to say, oh, chocolate cake again.
Oh, yeah. Well, my husband was just jumping for joy. I'll tell you that. And he loved this whole project more than anybody because, you know, he got to taste all the good ones. And there were only a few flops. I've had a few flops every now and again, but most of them turned out at least well enough that I was willing to try them again a second time. And I would love to tell you, if I can, about the holiday recipes, because they're particularly delicious, and they're traditional American-style Thanksgiving recipe sides, sans turkey, since it's a vegetarian cookbook. But, for instance, there's a sweet potato that is just beyond the beyond. It's baked sweet potatoes topped with a pound and a half of pecans, as we say in the South. And I glaze those pecans in coconut sugar and salt and cinnamon and ghee. That's all there is. But it's a pound and a half of them on top of about a dozen potatoes. And then I bake them to reheat them. And everybody talks about those potatoes. They ask for them every single year. Bit.
All right. What else do you serve for holiday?
Well, I do all the traditional sides. So I do a dressing, and I make it gluten-free. So sometimes I make it with cornbread. Now that I've developed a gluten-free bread, if I'm in the mood to bake that, I'll do that first. And, of course, you could use a gluten-free commercial bread. And then I use the traditional spices, parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme. I also have a little hidden cumin and coriander there. I use a little cumin and coriander in almost everything because I think it gives this added oomph to any vegetarian food. You don't necessarily taste it because you taste all the parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme, but it also gives that added depth of flavor that you don't get when you're not eating meat. And it also balances enzymes in your body as you're eating cumin and coriander. Then I add shiitake mushrooms and some walnuts, homemade stock, bake it for a nice long time, and it's really delicious. I do make a fresh cranberry salad. I think it's got pineapple and apples and celery in it and walnuts and fresh cranberries, a little bit of coconut sugar. I never use any refined sugar because it's so inflammatory. But coconut sugar, I think, is so much more delicious also in baked goods. I much prefer cookies baked with coconut sugar than white sugar, and because it's just a much richer flavor. And so, anyway, I was back to the cranberry salad. And all of a sudden, I'm thinking about chocolate chip cookies.
Ah. Oh, yeah. Oh, the pictures of chocolate chip cookies. Oh, my God.
And then I'll make, to finish out Thanksgiving, I'll usually make a savory tofu dish with some spices, some ginger, garlic, maybe a little bit of cumin, coriander, and vinegar, balsamic vinegar, and bake that. And then I do a very simple, what I call elegant green beans made with leeks sauteed. And this is one of the only dishes I use dry basil instead of fresh. I just love the taste of it. And I mix it up with Bragg's, which is a gluten-free soy sauce. So I mix up cuisines together, you'll notice. I'm adding, I add basil and oregano to a soup that also has Indian spices. And so I just mix it all up, and it, I think, makes for some unique flavors.
Well, coriander is one of my favorite spices because I can grow it myself.
Oh, good for you. So you have fresh cilantro in your yard?
Yeah, it's fresh cilantro.
Oh, how wonderful.
Kind of almost wild. I mean, once you plant it, it reseeds itself year after year.
And, oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, and I almost always don't eat nearly enough of it. It goes to seed, and then I have coriander. Now, it's a little hard the outside of the coriander seed is pretty hard, and it's a little tough to, you have to grind it in order to really.
Yeah, I've never grown it. We have so many trees, we don't have enough sun really to have much of a garden. But so that's really interesting. I've never grown it, and that sounds great. And you know, cilantro is one of the cooling spices. So part of the principle of balance in Ayurveda is you want to eat cooling foods in the summer. I mean, this is natural common sense too. I mean, that's where Ayurveda comes from observing the natural world and what works. But cilantro and coriander are cooling spices, as are mint, as is mint, and cooling foods might be cucumbers, celery, raw foods in general are cooling and not suggested by Ayurveda, but if you were going to eat raw foods, they're best in the summer. And so I use that cilantro and mint all the time. You might want to check out my carrot soup recipe, which is made with cilantro and mint and coconut milk. And then I shift it for winter because once it gets cold, we want to stay in tune with the seasons. And so I take out the cooling ingredients, and then I add, I make it with almond milk instead of coconut milk because coconut is very cooling. And then I add a lot of fresh ginger and basil, which are warming. So then it's perfect for winter. So I think you'll enjoy that soup.
Oh,
and it's really easy to make, easy to make.
Well, Lisa, we're almost out of time, but can you just say a few words about about She Writes, which is your publisher?
Oh, yeah, thank you. She Writes Press is just a wonderful, wonderful press that was founded by Brooke Warner, and it's a press of mostly women writers. It's an independent press, and Brooke is now the president of the Independent Publishers Association as well, and it's been recognized for innovation. So it is a self-funded press, but it has all the supports of traditional publishing. So they do a lot of education with us, with the writers, much more so in some of the traditional houses, and they put the book together. So it's their incredible team, their designer, and they get it printed, and they train you in marketing. They have a distribution arm and a sales force. So She Writes Press books can get into bookstores and other retail places. And so it's available anywhere where books are sold. If you have an independent bookstore, I love to support them. You can ask your bookstore to order it for you. And, of course, it's available on Amazon right now.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Lisa. And
thank you.
I look forward to trying some of these recipes. They really sound delicious.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much for having me. I've so enjoyed it.
And Mom, do you
and
have
happy
some...
holidays to
oh,
you.
Yes.
They're just around the corner. Can
Absolutely.
You believe it?
Yeah, I know.
Mom, do you have some final words for us?
Well, this one's a short one, but it's been around for a long time, and it fits. You are what you eat.
That's right. You are what you eat.
Thank you, and see you all next week on Writer's Voices.
Bye-bye.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.